Coming up on the 21st today, what problems do we face keeping the world's largest freshwater system clean?
My childhood along the riverbanks was in the mid-70s. I used to get in trouble for going down to the river to play, and it wasn't because my parents were afraid I was going to drown. It was because it was so filthy. It was like going to play at the dump.
Dan Egan covers the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's also author of a new book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. He joins us to talk about the history, present, and future of the lakes. Plus,
part of what La Vida does is give these players and their families a space to share these stories, both to the Latino community, but actually this is why the Hall of Fame is doing it, beyond Latinos.
We'll revisit our conversation with Adrian Burgos Jr. He's editor-in-chief of La Vida Baseball and the University of Illinois' baseball historian. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A great lake can hold all the mysteries of an ocean and then some. So writes Dan Egan, a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, in his new book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Those of us in this part of the world know the treasure of the Great Lakes. We also know its challenges, whether it's Asian carp getting into Lake Michigan, algae blooms on Lake Erie, the water quality warnings we all seem to get every summer. What other problems do we face keeping the world's largest freshwater system clean? And what other some simple fixes we can do to protect it? And what problems do we have to worry about within these lakes spreading to other American waterways? That's all in the topic of this. Those are all topics in this book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Dan, who, by the way, is the only full-time journalist whose beat is covering the Great Lakes for the Journal Sentinel, is speaking this evening in Chicago at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore at 6 o'clock. I spoke with him earlier when he just started his book tour. Hey, Dan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you grew up near Lake Michigan, right? What are your first memories of the lake?
I did. I actually grew up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, not far from the banks of the Fox River, which is a tributary to Lake Michigan. And I was born in 1967, so my childhood along the riverbanks was in the mid-70s. And I remember I used to get in trouble for going down to the river to play, and it wasn't because my parents were afraid I was going to drown. It was because it was so filthy. It was like going to play at the dump.
And so that was one
experience or set of experiences that I had as a kid. I mean, I remember picking up nuggets of sulfur off the riverbank, and my brothers and I would bring it back to our house, and we'd light it like some kind of a low-grade firework because it would melt and ooze and stink, a sulfury stink, and thinking, wow, this is nature's bounty. You know, look what the rivers provide.
Nature's bounty.
not
how would you describe that now?
Well, I subsequently learned that I believe it's part of the pulp making process. It just precipitates out of the water. But the river was a mess back then. I guess that's my point. But another relationship that I had, experience that I had with the lakes was just an hour north on the Door Peninsula. Both sets of grandparents, they both lived in Green Bay, and they both had summer homes up just an hour north of Green Bay, up where the water was still clean and cold and fish-filled and plenty safe to swim in. So I really relished those trips as a kid, and I think that stuck with me, particularly when, after I graduated from college, I moved out west, and I worked at newspapers in Idaho and Utah, and you know, basically lived in the desert for 12 years and then coming back to Wisconsin and to work at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I looked at the lakes completely differently. I guess it's an appreciation you get for living in the desert that long.
So I was really fascinated when I read in your book that the Great Lakes are not really separate lakes, but if we maybe should think of them more as sort of like one giant slow motion river that flows from west to east. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, they don't really think about it, but yeah, the lakes are not a closed, you know, static system. They're constantly flowing from, you know, as far west as Duluth. They're drifting east. Lake Superior runs down the St. Mary's River into Lakes Huron and Michigan, which are really just one lake. And those lakes mostly flow out the St. Clair River into Lake Erie, and Lake Erie tumbles into Lake Ontario, and the St. Lawrence River takes it all out to the ocean. And so to get some kind of idea of how fast or how slow all this water is flowing, they talk about residence time for each lake. And I believe for Lake Michigan, it's 99 years. And that's basically how long it would take a drop of water to make its way out of Lake Michigan. Or another way to look at it, that's how long it would take for the lake to replenish itself.
Wow.
Now, I said that's how they flow. There is one exception, one significant exception, and that's down at Chicago.
Yeah, the Chicago River. And we're going to get to that because I want to talk about the ways that we have changed the lake. But before we get to the present, I also really love the history of this. And you start the book with sort of this notion of the 17th century explorer, is it Jean Nicolet, appearing on the shores of Lake Michigan in Chinese robes because he thinks he's reached Asia. I wonder, it's just such a great image, but what did you learn about the history of the Great Lakes when you started writing this book?
Well, speaking of that specifically, you know, I don't know if that's apocryphal or not, but growing up in Green Bay, there is a statue just north of Green Bay, you know, where, you know, he allegedly landed and with his two pistols blaring, and there's actually quite a famous painting. It was done, gosh, I don't know, probably in the late 1800s, and I think it's with the Wisconsin State Historical Society. But it's kind of an iconic image that school kids, up at least in Wisconsin, at least school kids my age, were exposed to and are familiar with. But you know, the most important thing in my mind is to appreciate how isolated they were. I mean, they're so big and vast. The five lakes together span 94,000 square miles, which means nothing to me except for I looked up what 94,000 square miles is roughly equivalent to, and that's the United Kingdom. You know, it's a lot of surface area. What's important to realize is, despite the size of these lakes, they were essentially isolated from the rest of the aquatic world as a pond in the north woods of, say, Wisconsin. And that's because on their western end, they were separated by what they call a subcontinental divide, which really is kind of a continental divide, which prevented waters from the Mississippi from mixing with the Great Lakes. And then on the eastern side, there's Niagara Falls. So things might be able to tumble over the falls, but, you know, that's a long way down. There's no way anything was going to swim up. And that's, I'm speaking of the four upper lakes, specifically Erie, Michigan, Huron, and Superior. But below Niagara Falls, you have Lake Ontario, and below that, you had a roaring St. Lawrence River that was impossible to paddle up, and I think very unlikely that anything could swim up. So yeah, they were biologically separated from the rest of the world, and we didn't want to leave them that way.
Right, we didn't want to leave them that way, right? I mean, we're thinking about this great mass of waterways. We think about the Erie Canal, the St. Lawrence Seaway. At what point do you think in American history we first sort of thought about redirecting or trying to sort of harness the power of that for, I guess, really for economic good or for our industry in the country?
Yeah, well, you know, all of this makes sense at the time that these decisions were made. It's just, you know, with the...
That's probably the theme of this book, right? All of these things that we're about to talk about.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. So, I mean, even George Washington realized that there had to be some kind of connection between the eastern seaboard and the rapidly expanding settlements of the West. I mean, to the south, there were Spanish colonies. To the north, there were French colonies. And there was no real reason for these settlers west of the Appalachians to feel any kind of economic or cultural connection to the eastern seaboard if it was hard to come by. And so Washington early on thought, we've got to get a canal into the interior. And it wasn't until 1824, I believe, that they finally did it with the Erie Canal, which was the first connection between the lakes and the outside world. And it was a set of canals, it was a canal with a set of locks that linked Albany, New York to Buffalo, New York. It basically linked Lake Superior or Lake Erie to the Hudson River. And from the Hudson River, you've got access to the rest of the world. That was the first kind of crack in the protective skin.
Right. So,
and
yeah.
Not long after that, the Canadians built their own canal system, which bypassed Niagara Falls, the Welland Canal, and gave access to Lake Erie as well. That was about 5 years later, and that was really the system that continues to operate today. That was really the genesis of what's known as the St. Lawrence Seaway.
And the St. Lawrence Seaway, I think, so that's fast forward, right, about 125 years or so to the St. Lawrence Seaway. What was the idea behind that when it was constructed in 1959? Because I think this is another kind of file under good ideas at the time, right?
Yeah. And, you know, to be clear, there was a canal system linking the lakes, the upper lakes, to the eastern seaboard ever since that Welland Canal opened back in the late 1820s. But it was small. It was really small. And they kept expanding the Welland Canal. They kept making it bigger. And then all the canals along the St. Lawrence River, because it was too wild for navigation in its natural state. And it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then finally in the 1950s, they decided we've got to make this big enough so we can get, you know, a lot of ocean traffic coming into the lakes. Because before that, it was primarily kind of a boutique business, just these, you know, relatively small boats able to make the passage from, say, you know, Chicago or Milwaukee out to the eastern seaboard. So the idea behind the Seaway was to go big, and it was to turn Chicago and Milwaukee and Duluth and Buffalo into ports that would rival those on the coasts. And, you know, it all seemed like a really good idea. And at the time, people were thinking, we can turn the Great Lakes into the North American Mediterranean. There were a couple of problems. One, they built it too small. It would have been incredibly expensive to build it to match the ships that are commonly on the seas today. But even in the 1950s, it was small for its era, and so that kind of locked in the size of boats that could get into the lakes as like a pre-World War II era sized fleet. So it was small to begin with, in some ways obsolete to begin with. And another big problem is ice. You know, shipping corridors need to be open year-round because businesses need their products year-round, and the Seaway and closes for 9 months a year.
Right, and so narrow. And it also gets to, the St. Lawrence Seaway gets into one of the main topics of your book. It's sort of also how we open the front door to invasive species coming into the Great Lakes. How can you tell us how that, what happened there?
Yeah, and this was something that nobody really pondered at the time, but, you know, these boats, relatively small as they are, they're still big. I mean, they're 700 feet, almost 80 feet wide, and can draw about 27 feet. So they can hold a lot of cargo, and that means they have to be able to hold a lot of ballast water. Ballast water is used to stable a ship if it doesn't have an evenly balanced cargo load, or if it has no cargo. It basically allows a ship to sail safely on open water. It's just as critical to the safety of a crew as properly functioning wing flaps are to a pilot trying to land a plane. I mean, it's necessary. Unfortunately, it isn't dead weight. It's anything but. So these ballast tanks can get filled up with, you know, water at a port on the other side of the Atlantic, and what comes aboard is not just water, but anything lurking in that water. And a lot of these organisms have, you know, a tolerance for some salinity, but they're primarily freshwater organisms. And so these ships started arriving in 1959, and then so did the pace of new species showing up in the lakes. And since the 1950s, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe it's almost 60 non-native species have arrived due to ballast since the Seaway
wow,
opened. And at the peak, they were arriving every, two a year, they were discovering them. So it was really an unintended consequence of opening up the lakes to deep draft navigation.
And before
and one that we're still
right.
suffering from today.
And before we get to the other species that we deliberately put into the lake, I want to ask you about just what, can you give us a sense of the ecosystem of what native species, what kind of fish were we seeing or were originally part of the Great Lakes system?
Yeah, I mean, and it's simplified.
Would you say like walleye, whitefish?
Well, yeah, you had lake trout. Lake trout were at the top.
Okay.
And then there were these whitefish-like species called ciscos, and there were, I believe, seven of them. And they could grow as big as 2 feet. And then you had whitefish, and then you had perch and walleye, and then all sorts of tiny little fish that, you know, had no commercial or nutritional appeal to people and weren't really heavily studied. But the ciscos and mostly the lake trout were heavily, heavily fished. I mean, they were providing protein to people, not just on the shores of the lake, but as far away as Denver and New York. And that whole system collapsed real fast, and I think it had been compromised by the overfishing. But then it was the arrival of the sea lamprey, which swam up the Welland Canal and into the upper Great Lakes and took out the lake trout and just literally more than decimated them. I mean, they extirpated lake trout on Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, and to a lesser degree took them out up on Lake Superior. And with the top of the food chain gone, you know, that opened up the lakes to all manner of chaos. And what we ended up with was an alewife.
Yeah. Dan, we're going to take a break. If you hold on a second, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dan Egan, author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Dan Egan. He's the author of Death and Life of the Great Lakes. He's actually the only full-time journalist whose beat is covering the Great Lakes. He does that for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're actually speaking to him. He's just started his book tour. The book's just come out. By the way, you can catch him this evening. He's speaking at the Seminary Co-op Bookstore in Chicago at 6 o'clock. We'll tweet out all the details for that. And if you want more information about that, Dan, just before the break, we were just talking about sort of all of the different species, what did exist, what changed. And I want to get to the story of Howard Tanner. He's someone I learned about in your book, and it's kind of remarkable to me. Can you tell us the story of how he ended up putting salmon into the Great Lakes?
Yeah, so as I was saying, sea lamprey came in and took out the lake trout, and then behind the sea lamprey came the alewives, which are an ocean herring that have the ability to also spend their whole lives in freshwater. And so they swam up the Welland Canal behind the sea lamprey, and when they got in here, they were too small for the lamprey to attack, and there was really nothing to eat them, so they just exploded. And I'm sure some of your listeners will remember the dark days, back in the late 1960s when Lake Michigan was just... The beaches were insufferable. They were just packed with mounds of dead alewives. Mm. And the reason they were always washing up and dying is because they're a true saltwater fish, so they were constantly under stress being in freshwater. And I think the mechanism that kills them are some of the big swings in temperatures, water temperatures in the lakes. They're fragile to begin with, so they die off easily. And there were so many in the lakes in the 1960s that one estimate at the time was 90% of the fish biomass in the lake was alewives. So for every 10 pounds of fish swimming around out there, 9 pounds of them were alewives. And it was a disaster. And so two things happened. First of all, a group of federal researchers spent about 5 years studying sea lamprey. Now, sea lamprey, they kill the lake trout, but they're a parasite, and they look like an eel, kind of a snake-like thing, and they attach themselves to the belly or back of their prey, and then just basically suck the blood and the juices out of them.
Wow, that sounds awful.
one lamprey can kill 40 pounds of fish in its short lifetime. So So the lamprey couldn't really do the same thing to the alewives because the alewives weren't a big enough meal for them. So the alewives just grew like weeds. And once the scientists realized how to control the lamprey, and that's a story unto itself. I mean, they studied their life cycle and realized that they weren't just swimming willy-nilly out in the lakes. They were spawning in very specific streams, and they targeted those streams with a very specific poison and were able to control lamprey numbers to about 10% of their peak. So that opened the door. That was in the earlier mid-60s, and that opened the door to the restoration of a predator to bring some balance back to the food web. And I guess the natural option would have been to bring back lake trout. And
right.
While they had been knocked out on Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, there were remnant populations on Lake Superior and in some other North American lakes. As a matter of fact, there's Lake Michigan lake trout swimming in Yellowstone Lake where they're an invasive species. But there was a gene pool where they could have gone back and gotten, you know, Great Lakes lake trout to replant in Lakes Michigan and Huron. But Howard Tanner, who is a Michigan native, a graduate of Michigan State University, a fisheries biologist who started his career out west managing reservoirs in Colorado where, you know, those aren't natural water bodies, so it's all about stocking, and these biologists get to kind of pick what they want in the water, and or it's a trial and error program to see what works. Well, he spent his early career out in Colorado, and then he was brought back to Michigan right around the time of the alewife infestation, and he was giving marching orders from his boss to, let's do something spectacular here. And Howard, who is a great guy, just as he can tell a fascinating story, he said he didn't come back trying to solve an alewife problem. That wasn't his goal. His goal was to create the best sport fishery he possibly could on the Great Lakes, and it just so happened that that would also hopefully control the alewife population. So he and his staff looked at a number of species, and they came to the conclusion that Pacific salmon would be a good fit for the lakes because alewives are an ocean species themselves, and they school in a manner that the salmon favor. And so Michigan, without any, you know, formal and probably not a lot of informal.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy because this is, again, it seemed like a good idea at the time, which I feel like is a little bit of the theme of your book.
It was a good idea. I don't know. I mean, it's a good debate. Could we have done the same thing with lake trout? And you know, lake trout they'll eat alewives, but they're not built to eat alewives the way or fish like alewives the way salmon are. And so the salmon really did solve the alewife problem. But, you know, it's created some long-term problems, and that's kind of where we are today. I mean, first of all, nobody debated it. You know, nobody said, well, what are the potential downsides to this? Or do we really want to introduce a completely foreign fish to these Great Lakes? I mean, an analogy may be somebody saying, let's bring, you know, hippos and elephants to the UP and create a hunting preserve, you know, at the expense of all the deer. It was radical, but it worked at controlling the alewives, and it worked at creating a constituency for the lakes. It brought people out on the water to a degree that they hadn't been in decades. And even before the lake trout collapsed, the only people who were really on the lake were commercial fishermen. Salmon brought out the recreational fishermen, and they brought them out in numbers that nobody ever expected. And so this was in the late 60s, and it was a real booming business all the way up until about 10 years ago on Lake Huron, and it's still going pretty well in Lake Michigan, but it's getting a little shaky, and that's because the alewives are collapsing, and that's because there's more invasive species have since come in, and they're competing with the alewives at the bottom end of the food chain. So the alewives aren't finding enough to eat, and then they're being eaten, And if they disappear, so will the salmon, because that's really the only thing that will sustain them out there.
Yeah, Dan, I'm speaking with Dan Egan. He's the author of Death and Life of the Great Lakes. It's a new book that's just out. How would you describe the health of the Great Lakes now? I wonder, you know, we've been talking about, you know, we started by talking about what the pollution looked like in the lake when you were a kid. We've been talking about all of the invasive species that exist within the lakes. We haven't talked as much about the environmental impacts, but where do you think we're at?
Well, we're at an interesting moment in time. I mean, what's happening on Lake Huron is just a fascinating story of native species making a comeback. So what's happened, this is kind of complicated stuff, but it's really interesting. So the alewives sustained the salmon fishery, but they couldn't get, Even though they were planting millions upon millions of salmon, the states were, the federal government was still trying to plant lake trout, and they were having a real difficult time getting lake trout to reproduce on their own. They were sustained primarily through hatchery plantings. And it turns out a big reason why is that when lake trout do eat alewives, it creates a thiamine deficiency in their offspring, so they don't live to maturity. So now that the alewives are gone, and the salmon are followed the alewives because that's what they eat, lake trout are starting to come back. And the reason they're coming back is that they're opportunists. And so, as I was saying earlier, the alewives kind of got starved out by mussels, and then another species came in. And I say mussels, I mean zebra and quagga mussels.
Mm-hmm.
Then this round goby comes in, and it's viewed as just as much of a noxious invader.
Yeah, it's like a bottom feeder, right?
Yeah, and people looked at it just like we looked at alewives in the 1960s, like, oh, you know, these are cockroaches. But it turns out these gobies eat mussels because they came from the same place, the Caspian Sea Basin, and they came over the same way in ballast water of ocean-going ships. So now the gobies are eating mussels, and native fish are eating gobies. So they've basically unlocked this previously nutritional dead end that was the quagga and zebra mussels blanketing the bottom of the lakes. So on Lake Huron, they've basically lost their lucrative salmon fishing business, but walleye, whitefish, lake trout, they're all doing really well.
Yeah, they're coming back.
They're adapting to eat gobies. And I think we're headed in that direction on Lake Michigan. Lake Superior's kind of a different story because it's just a different environment up there. It hasn't had the mussel problem, and that's largely just because of the water chemistry. It doesn't have the calcium for the shells to be able to grow.
You know, I grew up in Florida. I think I learned to value the Everglades and that ecosystem as part of my childhood. I don't think I learned to truly appreciate the Great Lakes until I went to college in Michigan and then I moved to Chicago. Do you think people outside of our area value the Great Lakes and what they are?
Well, I think they're large. They don't think about them, but if they do, and if they're kind of put in their global context, and you look at it, and it's like, oh my gosh, this is as geographically unique or distinct as the Himalayas. I mean, there's nothing like these things, and fresh water is really, you know, the one thing, one liquid we can't do without, and they're not making any more of it, and so I think that they'll become more economically and strategically important. It's inevitable in the coming century. But the other thing, and this is, talk about things that are crazy that blow me away. So quagga mussels have gotten out west. You know, they rode out the current on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal.
Got what kind of mussels?
Quagga and zebra mussels.
Okay.
So they're
I know the zebra
thing.
Mussels,
they're not the same. Yeah, okay. Quaggas are like, quagga mussels came in and just carpeted the lake. I mean, they are literally 10 times worse as far as like numbers, and they do their work year round. They feed year round. They can live at depths that the zebras can't. They can live on soft surfaces. Anyway, they made their way out west, and so now you have like boat ramps at Lake Mead where they get 5,000 boaters on a busy, you know, Memorial Day weekend, and they have huge lines, and they're like inspecting the boats looking for mussels, and there's dozens of boat ramps, and there's hundreds of these lakes, so there's got to be thousands of boat ramps all across the west, and you know, they're basically, you know, trying to catch fleas just out there in the open. I mean, there's just no way to stop it. But this is so. I mean, they have people. I was out there at Lake Powell, and they're inspecting swim noodles. They're giving them hot washes to like kill because the small mussels are so small you can't see them. They have all these hot water blasting stations. That's the big problem. Like, you don't know the value of prevention if you do it right. All people remember is the hassle. If we would have stopped ships coming up the St. Lawrence Seaway in the 80s when we were warned about zebra mussels, the only thing people would remember is that we stopped a perfectly good industry because we were afraid of some clam.
You know, when people hear all of this, and we always hear about invasive species, I can't believe we've had this entire conversation and we haven't even mentioned Asian carp. We just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to just ask you, you know, as someone who's reported on this, who's done so much extensive, you know, work on this, when you think about all of these species that we've either unintentionally or intentionally put into the lake and sort of how nature has kind of reasserted itself, do you have an opinion about how all of these things, do you have a sense of how much a philosophy about what we put in and if we should try to be writing things back to the way they were? Or if you think
Yeah, that's a good question. And so, you know, you're asking about the health of the lakes. And what I'm saying is, you know, it looks like there's a balance that's returning to Lake Huron that doesn't depend on nonstop hatchery plantings of an exotic fish that really, really doesn't belong in the lakes any more than, say, Asian carp do, and I'm talking about the salmon. And so, you know, I guess what I hope going forward is that, you know, they've taken a great step toward eliminating ballast water invasions by requiring ships to flush their ballast tanks out in the ocean to expel or kill unwanted hitchhikers. But that, there's still potential for more species to come. I mean, the science shows that the store is still open, and all it takes is one new species to rewire the way the energy is flowing through the system, and everything can break down again, and chaos can ensue in ways that nobody can predict. So I think it's really important that we do what we can to the extent that we can, to close this door to new invasions. And I guess I mean two doors. One would be the front door, the St. Lawrence Seaway, and the other would be the back door, which is the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, the path up which the dreaded Asian carp are inexorably migrating.
Yeah. And Dan, I wonder if we just have about a minute left or so. I wonder, what do you think will happen if we don't do that?
Nobody knows. That's the thing. I mean, nobody knew what was going to happen with mussels when they came in, and they completely upended the lake. And, you know, it may be decades or it may be a couple of years. The conventional wisdom is that the open waters of the lake have been pretty decimated plankton-wise by the mussels. So they basically beat the Asian carp to the punch out in the open waters. But there's plenty of food for the carp to find in the bays, harbors, and rivers that feed the lakes, and that also happens to be where most of the people are recreating. And so it could be big trouble. We won't know. And the heck of prevention is, if we do stop them, nobody's going to appreciate what we stopped because they won't realize it. You know, all they'll realize is, oh, we did this expensive thing on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal by plugging it or replumbing it or rejiggering the way it works. If we don't do that and things go crazy again, I guess, you know, our grandkids are going to be wondering what the heck we were thinking.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in here that we didn't have a chance to get to, but the death and life of the Great Lakes is by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Dan Egan. He's got a couple events in Illinois this week, so we'll tweet those out. Dan, thanks so much for being with me. Thanks for spending a little bit of time with us talking about what's inside the Great Lakes.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode.
Hola!
La vida baseball.
Well, our stories are told.
Describe my country.
Awesome.
It's beautiful.
My father and my two grandpas, they are my heroes.
We don't really have a glove until we're like 10 or 12.
Like this?
They always ask me, what's my favorite dish? And I go, arepas, and they're like, what?
Rice and beans, chicken.
Say pollo.
You just gotta get a chance. You get a chance, you fight for your dream, and you'll be in the big league.
Our game.
Nuestra voz.
Our history.
Our story.
Tell your mom and abuelita about us.
That's a clip from La Vida Baseball. It's a new digital media company that was launched by the National Baseball Hall of Fame earlier in March. Here's a stat for you since we're talking baseball. In 1990, 16% of Major League Baseball players were Latino. By 2015, that percentage had doubled. There's no question that the Latino love affair with baseball isn't just with the players, but the community. And that's the idea behind this site. Its editor-in-chief is none other than Illinois' own Adrian Burgos Jr., a baseball historian at the University of Illinois. He joined us in studio the day after La Vida Baseball was launched back in March. Hey, Adrian, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me on.
So 54 million Latinos living in the U.S. Do you think it's safe to say that means 53.5 million are baseball fans?
Well, maybe not 53.5, but, you know, we have a young generation. They use social media, and this is where we think we can actually connect with them and tell them the stories, which are our stories. The stories of Latinos in baseball is about immigration. It's about migration. It's about acculturation. It's about assimilation. It's all those things. And so we get this forum to share those stories. And one of the things I love about La Vida Baseball is that we talk to these players. We talk to our legends. We go into the community about what life and baseball is about. Not just, it's not about what's going on between the white lines of the playing field. It's how do you live a life? They're coming from Dominicans, 16 years old, and how they grow up in the United States and they form friendships and relationships with other Latinos. In many instances, you know, it's their first exposure. And we heard some of the ball players talking about the different foods that they like, and you know, they're learning from each other because Venezuelans, they love arepas.
I was going to say arepas. It's such a Venezuelan thing. And then you heard the chicken and rice or the black beans. I didn't hear any. I'm surprised there was no Cuban black beans and rice in there.
Well, that's coming.
That's coming. All right. And I was looking at some of the social media reaction to the site. A question a lot of people were asking, I was seeing on Twitter, why hasn't this happened before? So I guess that's my question. What was behind this is something the National Baseball Hall of Fame is producing.
It's in partnership with the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And to me, what was exciting, just down in spring training a couple weeks ago and last week, and I go up to Carlos Beltran, Puerto Rican player with the Astros, and I shared with him, this is the Hall of Fame reaching out to us, Latinos in the U.S., across the Americas, and the time is right because we have Pedro Martinez that went in to the Hall of Fame. We have this year Ivan Pudge Rodriguez. We have more guys coming, Mariano Rivera. Others are coming. This is the moment to really reach out. Why hasn't it happened before? You know, I think part of it was that the Hall of Fame had to engage in this project of education of its fans, and that was what the Viva Baseball exhibit. And this is the 21st century version, and it transformed now into La Vida Baseball, a multi-channel digital platform so players can talk and share, and will be on social, on Twitter, on Instagram. And for me as a historian, it's about having the informing these stories through a historical perspective, but about how it relates to today and to the experience of these players. And it's a great way to engage the public through scholarship, through engagement of just everyday questions and matters, and have fun, because this is what it is for these players. I love seeing the players react to what we ask them, because it's about the life of a ball player and the culture around baseball.
And so can you tell us a little bit more? This is a digital media company. Is the site basically kind of like a digital magazine? Would that be a good way to describe it?
That is a perfect way to describe it. We are a digital magazine that have outreach through video. We'll have, you know, long, short form written content. We'll have social media in terms of Twitter and Instagram, kind of memes that we'll produce. We hired a Latino, Henry Pacheco, who's a UCLA grad. He's a film and studies guy, and he has experience with La Flama and a number of social media content. And again, the team we put together, myself, Clemson Smith Muniz, Henry, we're Latinos, we're bilingual, we can relate to the players, we know the culture, we learn more about it every day. And that's part of what this is about. It's about educating others and ourselves across Latinos and amongst Latinos, but actually broadcast it out. What the Hall of Fame is doing is saying, this is such an important story. We need to partner up. Teamworks Media has invested in it. They believe in it. They've put their own money into it and said, this is the 21st century to get this story out there.
The site's primarily in English, or would we say the site's Spanglish also?
Well, the written content right now is it's going to be in English. But when we talk to the players, when I approach them, it's like English or en español, however you want to talk, we'll talk. And so a lot of the videos you'll see will be Spanish and English. And some of the players like myself will move back and forth.
Right, sure.
Because that's really part of the experience of Latinos in the United States. Over 60% of Latinos in the United States identify as baseball fans. But what's really amazing is that most Latinos consume their news through mobile, through devices. They spend 14...
And in English as well.
And in English. That's right. Exactly right.
Right.
So this is, again, a way to reach out to them and to engage them where they're at. And I think this is going to be why this property will be successful.
Well, and it's also from a business proposition, when you look at purchasing power in Latino households, this makes a lot of sense to be reaching out also.
Exactly. And, you know, this is where we're at. We're about reaching out. And this is both showcasing, but also, you know, marketing to the Latino community, letting them have a voice, a place, and a space. That's what La Vida is about.
And so you're launching the site. Is this the anniversary of Minnie Minoso's death, dying 2 years ago? How much of that was part of your thinking as well?
You know, I think it's appropriate that today we're launching La Vida Baseball because Minnie is La Vida Baseball. And his spirit, his character, that is what we want people to become educated about, to engage. And there are a lot of players like Jose Abreu today and others who live that story. And what I found really profound in talking to these players and even talking with Pudge Rodriguez 2 days ago in Cooperstown, the reverence they have for their elders who came through and were pioneers for Clemente, for Minoso, that is part of La Vida Baseball. There's this respect about the mentorship, the brotherhood, the family that helped players get to this point. And in my own biography, baseball has been family. It was my connection to my grandmothers. They're the ones who kind of turned me on to how to be a Latino baseball fan, not just a Puerto Rican baseball fan.
Yeah, what does that mean if you're a Latino baseball fan?
So I asked my grandmother, Mercedes, a number of years ago. I was still in college. Are you a Yankees fan or a Mets fan? And she tells me, I'm a Yankees fan, but I also root for the Mets. I like my New York teams, but I root for every team that has the most Latinos. Whenever there's a team with the most Latinos, that's who I'm rooting for. And I was like, wow, this is actually how I root for baseball teams myself.
And then you do this now too?
Exactly.
So who are you rooting for now then?
Oh, man. You know, it is so challenging. Because
I was going to say, that's a tough one these days to think about.
And so many of these teams have so many Latino players. As you noted before, we have, you know, between U.S. Latinos and foreign-born Latinos, approximately one-third of Major League Baseball. And there are teams like the Seattle Mariners who have lots of Latino stars and up-and-coming players.
Well, I'm thinking about the Sox, right?
Yeah, the Sox. Well, and don't forget Javi Baez on the north side and Wilson Contreras. And you have Lindor. What's really fascinating about this moment and another part of our inspiration for launching La Vida Baseball is we have guys like Big Papi who just retired. We have guys like Mariano Rivera who just retired a couple years back and Pedro. But now you have this young generation of Francisco Lindor, Javi Baez, who are like the future of baseball right now. And they're exciting. They're leading their teams. And so we want to connect with their generation.
Well, in their generation, and I'm thinking about the Sox having the only Mexican-American manager, when you think about managers as well, Ricky Renteria, like that's, you're also seeing now an evolution in the sport of not just players and coaches, but in management.
Right. And, you know, we have, ironically enough, I think more Latino GMs and managers at the moment with Al Avila and others. But yeah, and this is also part of the voice of La Vida Baseball is to speak through a Latino perspective on these issues. We see it in Clemson Smith Muniz's first piece, My Clemente, so that people can understand what Roberto Clemente means to him. Similarly, you know, what I wanted to get across in my launch piece that about stories to tell is really about this experience I had in Cuba, where the old Negro League player, Lorenzo Chiquitín Cabrera, who was suffering from diabetes, he was convalescing from just having his leg amputated. I was trying to be respectful of his time and of his condition. And I did a very short interview, about 10 minutes, got him on tape. And I said, thank you, Señor Cabrera, for your time. He reaches out and grabs my arm and says, is that it? I have more stories to tell. And I was like, well, then I'm staying. And that is what La Vida is about. there's stories to tell, and we're going to tell them.
How much of these stories are stories that maybe were known in baseball, that maybe were known within the Latino community, but maybe are not recognized in sort of broader baseball American, the American culture?
Yeah, I think part of what La Vida does is give these players and their families a space to share these stories, both to the Latino community, but actually this is why the Hall of Fame is doing it, beyond Latinos. This is the connection between the past, the present, and the future of baseball. And, you know, I think what's fascinating is when I reach out to a player and say, you have a chance to tell your story. Louis Tiant, we just were with him in Fort Myers, and we asked, you know, 5 minutes of your time, you're a legend. His first answer took 8 minutes, and he just began to settle in. And so we had over a half hour with Louis, and he wanted to share his stories. And the ability to let a player share what they went through is such a powerful moment, I think, for them. Because I tell them, I'm talking to Yadier Molina, and I'm like, ¿en inglés o en español? He's like, ¿en español? All right, let's go. And that's fine, because that's where he feels eloquent in, and that's where he can really express ideas. And I'm sitting across from Yadi, and he's almost in a catcher's crouch on the seat, leaning in into the interview. He's just sharing what he has to say. And then after, when we're done, he's like, that was fun. Thank you.
Well, and I was going to ask you that, Adrian. Do you have a sense, especially when you're thinking about players, your ability to communicate with players in Spanish? And we think, like, we see this in coaching staffs, right? Like, they now have coaches who can communicate with players in Spanish, but maybe that doesn't happen as much from a media perspective unless we're talking about Spanish language media. So I also wonder, for some of these guys, have they even had a chance to tell their story?
You know, again, what's La Vida is doing is, like, we're telling them, we're going to translate this, we're going to put it out in English, but just tell the story in the language you feel most comfortable in. That's what they've lacked, really. And that's the space that La Vida Baseball is going to fill and is filling, because it allows the player to just share their story. And they're already gaining trust in us. What was really interesting, I had a mutual friend of mine and Louis Tiant reach out to me and said, I was talking to Louis Tiant on the phone about something entirely different, and he mentioned La Vida Baseball to me and how much fun he had on the interview. And I was just like, wow, Louis is talking to our mutual friend about La Vida already because of the kind of space it provides him. He's one of our legends. And sure, the Boston media knows his story and understands, in a certain sense, his story. But La Vida Baseball is about Louis Tiant. It's about Manny Manoso. It's about Clemente. And it's about Baez, Molina, Lindor, Contreras, all these ball players. It's about their families. I was talking with Ivan Rodriguez's wife and family, and they're like, wow, this is so needed. You know, and it's like, well, join in. We're La Vida Baseball. We're your home. Tu casa.
And it's live now, lavidabaseball.com. It's editor-in-chief, baseball historian. He's based here at the University of Illinois, Adrian Burgos, Jr. Adrian, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks
I should
for
say
having
gracias.
Us on.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That does it for this special Encore edition of The 21st. Thanks for listening. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.